Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write just so happens to be what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You know, by the way, many of you folks listening may not know that, but all our interviews are archived. They're all free, and you can go on Author Magazine to the archive section and watch video interviews with authors as diverse as Amy Tan and Lee Child and Dennis Lehane, Richard Bach, Ken Robinson, Nora Ephron, Henry Winkler. They're all on there, and they're all free. So go check it out, authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn more about the PNWA, you can go to their website, pnwa.org. Our conference is coming up next week. I think I'm going to have the president of the PNWA on the show next week. We're going to talk about it. Writers Conference at SeaTac Hilton starting next Thursday. Ooh, probably still got some slots left if you want to sign up. It will be worth it. That's pnwa.org. So I think that today I'm going to do something a little bit different in lieu of my normal introduction. I'm going to read something from today from today's guest's book. My guest is Rita Zoe Chin, debut memoirist and poet. She's written a memoir, fabulous memoir too, I got to say, gripping. And just beautifully written. It's called Let the Tornado Come. And I'm going to read a little portion of the prologue, actually, which I think will set the table nicely for our discussion. So Rita writes, "Sometimes parts of our story feel so immediate when I think of them that they trump the present moment. The story of my childhood is the same. Those years of loss and wandering keep happening, as if they're rewriting themselves on the inside of my body, zapping me afresh some days while I'm busy living my new life. They say memory is like that, that to the brain there is little to distinguish a memory from the actual event. So as resounding and complete as any moment is, one side of it is always touching, even in the gentlest of ways, the past, where there is always a story inside the story waiting to be told." Beautiful. Let's get Rita on here and talk to her, the woman who wrote that. Rita, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. And let me say congratulations. I know this was published. We were trying to do the math earlier. 2 weeks ago, yes? Just came out.
Yeah, so 2 weeks old today.
And so how's it going so far? How's it been? This is your first published book, unless I've misunderstood something. This is your first published book. How's it going?
It is my first published book. It's going really well. It's a funny thing to, you know, sit with your tea and your pajamas. Not that I'm always in my pajamas, but you know, a lot.
Yes.
And write. And then another thing to be out in the world with the thing that you've written. So it's exciting and a lot of fun.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. Most authors do, but sometimes they find it just unwieldy and bizarre and disorienting. So it sounds like so far so good.
So far, so good. We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice to be able to connect with people, actually, which is, I think, a lot of the reason that we write in the first place. So I've really been enjoying that aspect of it.
That is the reason we write. It's important to remember that, isn't it? That we write for ourselves for sure, and yet writing for ourselves allows us to connect to others, doesn't it?
It does. I think it's always a dialogue. You know, we're not just talking into a vacuum, right, or writing into a vacuum, but presumably there's a listener on the other end or a reader.
Oh, there is. There is. And you're going to learn that now, boy. All right. So this is a memoir, and I'd love to give folks kind of a lay of the land. Let the Tornado Come is sort of follows three plot lines sort of overlapping. Could you let the folks know who haven't in the last 2 weeks had a chance to read it, what the story looks at, what the three sort of storylines are?
Sure. There are basically three journeys that I take at different points in my life where the odds are pretty heavily stacked against me. And what I've learned in writing this book is that I'm incredibly stubborn. and once I believe in something, I keep going. The first narrative starts when, you know, as a child, I started running away from home when I was 11. Um, is, I was born into a violent home, so I finally decided to take matters into my own hands. And so that first storyline kind of follows the years I spent from... I started running away when I was 11, but between age 13 and almost 16, I was out of the house for goods, either on the streets right. or institutionalized. So that's the first story. And then the second story is much later in life when I was settled and happy. I started having panic attacks out of the blue, or seemingly out of the blue. And so finding my way through that without medication is the second story in this book. And then the third story is while I was trying to find my way through that, I decided that in all my fear, I should get on a horse for the first time in my life. And that led me to a very panicky, kind of rebellious horse, not unlike
Perfect. Yeah, it was amazing. You got one. You got a horse version of yourself in a way.
I did. Thanks, universe. But that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, perfect.
So I had to help him through his panic. Those are the three narratives.
Well, it's just, it's so funny. I don't know if funny is the right word, but I teach memoir writing myself. And what I often tell my students is, look, in a way, every memoir is about the same things. What seemed like a horrendous experience, or maybe just an unpleasant experience, and from that, they forged their life. I mean, it's almost always that story of feeling weak and then finding your strength, or feeling being told you're stupid and being smart, or being homeless and finding a home, being panicked and finding calm. It's that story told again and again. And often a tough childhood is a part of it. But man, this one, you really have a tough childhood. This one is particularly rough. And I wanted to crawl on those pages and pull you out of it, but you had to do that yourself. I know. That's how it felt. Was it good to go back and write about it? I mean, I'm sure it was tough.
Was it good?
Was it good to do it? I mean, were you glad you were doing it?
No.
No.
That was not my favorite thing to write about. But it was in service to the larger story that you're talking about, which is the resilience of the human spirit and hope. And that we can climb out of all sorts of things and rise farther above them than we kind of ever thought possible. And so as I was writing that, I was lucky enough to be writing it from, the vantage point of now looking back and knowing that I'm okay and better than okay. If people have asked me, was that cathartic or was that, and it's like, no, it wasn't
that.
No,
it really wasn't. It was tough. It was tough to go back. Yeah, but now that's interesting because I was just – there's a memoir. Claire Dieterer wrote Poser, and I was teaching a class with her at the Chuckanut Writers Conference 2 weeks ago, and we did a class called Writing the Hardest Thing, and that's a fear a lot of the memoir writers have. And so what would your advice be to somebody who – because a lot of people have to write. Maybe they've been raped. Maybe they've been abused, like you had the abusive family, or they've been deathly poor or whatever it is. What is your advice to someone when they go back into those moments? And because you've got to tell them, that's your story. If it's really tough, you know it's your story, and you kind of have to tell it. So what's your advice to them?
Well, I think that, number one, you have to have enough distance from it that you're not emotionally engaged in it. It's not traumatizing to actually write it. So while I didn't enjoy it, I was far enough away from it that I could write it with perspective and without self-pity or anger, but just with a kind of clarity and, dare I say, like wisdom. I teach memoir as well, and I often tell my students that, even in the darkest moments, if you look hard enough, there are also attendant moments of light. And so I think even when we're writing those dark moments, I remember being a kid and, getting a beating and then, feeling grateful that I survived it and looking at this book of butterflies and, falling in love with the blue morpho butterfly because it was so unbelievably gorgeous. And so things still shine, and I think that it's important to try to keep a balance.
Well, and also life keeps moving. And your attention keeps moving. And so your attention went from being beaten to the butterfly, and you allowed yourself in the way children seem uniquely capable of moving on and focusing on the new thing and living that moment, even though that last moment had just happened. And I think children are particularly gifted at that or understand it in a way that adults forget. how to, maybe.
I think that's why I like dogs so much, just because they stay in the moment all the time.
Yeah.
I envy that.
Yeah. There was one part that was interesting to read, and I felt would be was probably challenging to write. One of the lectures I give is called Fearless Writing. It's dealing with the nature of fear while you're writing, and it's particularly deceptive because when you're writing, of course, there's nothing you can point to that you're afraid of because it's just you and your thoughts. And you wrote about panic attacks, and I thought how challenging that is. Maybe you can talk about how you approach that because, of course, when you're in your family and your father was being so abusive, you could write about him as the source of the pain and fear. But when it was your panic attacks, it was really just the question, like, what if? And I think it's more difficult to write that way than having a kind of villain to represent all the source of the pain. Does that make sense?
It does. Well, it's really interesting because, you know, if anyone's the villain in a panic attack, it's kind of you.
Absolutely.
It's happening inside your own body.
So
you can't run from yourself. And I'd been a runaway all my life, and then suddenly, you know, the thing that was scaring me was happening inside my own mind. I think it's definitely, you know, writing about panic. I mean, again, I had a distance. So by the time I wrote this book, I had come through it and was able to sort of even have a sense of humor a little bit about it. Like, wow, I was truly terrified to go through the checkout line in a grocery store. And, you know, I'm not notoriously been a fearful person. So, you know, but apparently there are, you know, 40 million anxious people just in this country alone right now. So knowing I wasn't alone helped. Just, you know, and it was also a journey, you know, trying to understand like the root of fear and how, you know, and just how panic is just ultimately is a part of ourselves that wants to feel safe. And, you know, so,
I've come up with a new definition of anxiety. Would you like to hear it? Because I deal with it myself and I have to deal with it in my children. My son was actually diagnosed on the autism spectrum, and I've come to understand that what we called autism was just anxiety expressed, and at least in his case. And I've come to see anxiety as attempting to solve problems that don't exist, that the behavior that expresses itself is an attempt to solve a problem that doesn't exist. It's the problem that the mind has created. And since it doesn't exist, the attempt to solve it just explodes, you know, makes us feel less and less safe. Does that resonate at all? What do you think?
That does resonate. I think that, you know, there are a million what ifs, you know, and, you know, I mean, I was, you know, afraid of everything, including that maybe I might, you know, spontaneously combust, who knows? And so it's endless. And I think you're right. It's also about control, right? Because we're afraid of losing control and ultimately of some bad fate happening to us. And
that's
so,
right.
Yeah, I think it comes to like a point of acceptance where you think, oh, everything will happen in this life, you know, amazing, joyful, beautiful things, and also, you know, bad things, scary things. And there's nothing we can do. It's all an illusion to think we can control it. So why not just kind of let go and you know,
But isn't writing interesting for the person who's anxious? Because when you sit at your desk, there you are alone, and you can summon any feeling you want. You can summon calm, you can summon fear, you can summon anger, you can summon anything, and all you're doing is sitting there. And hopefully you summon it in a way you can feel it on some level, not in the same way you would in the moment, but you want to feel it in order to write it. At least I have to.
Absolutely.
And nothing's happened.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because you're also going through all the, you know, the writerly things of not only the emotion, you know, making the emotion alive, but creating a world. So imagery and, you know, placing a reader and like kind of remembering what something looked like or smelled like or felt like. So it's very, you know, it's very sensory in that way too. I like the passage you read with just memory, you know, how there's little to sort of distinguish between the memory and the actual event.
And memory is interesting, too. I don't think I'm going to be able to find it. And if I can, actually, I'm going to try and find it, Rita. A little passage, just a description you gave. And if I can't, I'm not going to look real long because I don't want to eat up time. But it was a description of you driving out of your house. It's early on in the book. And it struck me as one of the interesting things the memoirist has to do. And if I can find it in the next 15 seconds, I'm going to read it. Otherwise, I'm not going to... Ah, here it is. Okay. So here's the
Excellent.
Description. I'm going to read it for our audience. And this is a... And to me, this is one of the things the memoirist has to do, and also a kind of deal they have to make with the truth. So this is what you wrote. This is chapter 5. And Larry, by the way, is Rita's husband. Dusk was slowly settling in as Larry and I got in the car and headed down the driveway, the sky shifting to evening pastels while clouds dusted past like sugar. The lanterns on our gateposts had just come on, and a bat shuddered overhead before swooping into the field across the road. The herd of belted Galloways who lived there were clustered together at the roadside, grazing. And I'm going to stop there. Now, I love that passage. It's a beautiful description of that. But, and you're getting ready to go off to this dinner with your husband. Now, I'm going to guess, as someone who has written memoir myself, that you cannot remember for sure that all those details were present as you drove out. And yet you had to build that moment. And so was it an amalgamation of things that could have been there and things you have seen there? Or like, no, I remember there were clouds dusted like sugar that day.
Well, you know, I think it's both. I think in memoir, you know, sometimes we have to recreate to the best of our memory the essence of, a time. But also that was a traumatic and kind of nerve-wracking evening because I was in the throes of panic and I was about to meet the hospital CEO and the dean and all these people and at a dinner. So I was really nervous, and I think that we tend to remember things better in when there's a trauma. Like, you know, I ran through a glass door when I was 9, and I remember every detail of it. And so I think that I really did remember that night because I was just so nervous in the car, and I was, like, hyper aware, I think.
I do.
I have a little bit of an uncanny memory, though, sometimes. But I think that your question is a good one because I think that as memoirists, oftentimes we do have to fill in and recreate based on, you know, what we think the night would have been like. Or, you know, it seems like, you know, in the best of our memory it was like, but, you know, the very specific details are there to sort of bring the reader in and make the landscape come to life.
Well, absolutely, because ultimately it seems to me that the thing you're ultimately in service to is a work of art, and you're trying to share something with the reader. And details bring that work of art to life. And you're not filming every moment and writing down, you know, every single thought you had. And so you have to go back and recreate what probably was there. And I feel that is totally okay. At least myself.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Bill, because actually that's one of the big things, and you probably find this too in teaching memoir writing, is, you know, we're making art here. And it's not I'm going to just throw up all the details of my life onto the page and hope some reader enjoys it. It doesn't work that way.
No. In fact, you know what I teach my memoir students? I say, nobody cares what happened to you, but they care what it felt like. They care about the emotional experience, but they don't actually care about you, not in that way. I mean, I did care about you, but you see, Rita, I was you while I was living that. So I cared about myself in your place. I became that little girl. I became the adult woman having panic attacks with the horses. But they don't actually care. I mean, they don't know you. They're never going to meet you probably. So they don't really care about you, but like a work of art, they want the emotional experience, right? What else do they care about?
Exactly. Exactly, it's a journey. We're taking them somewhere, and you know we can't just like leave them on the side of the road and then you know go into a diatribe or some like a 50-page soliloquy about nothing, you know, or about something that you know like the details. A lot of people want to put a lot of details about every day, or so it's an interesting thing to find that balance. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to turn your life into art. Use your life to tell a story. Your life to tell a story. So it makes it, and it, you know what's nice about that. Is it makes your life, it's not just about a bunch of crap that happened to you anymore. Now it has some greater sort of, at least for me, it feels like some greater purpose, that it's in service to something. Something was learned, something was grown, something blossomed, you know, not just, you know, a bunch of junk that came down the pike my way.
Exactly. It has a shape. And, you know, that's why I like thinking of this book as three stories or three journeys, because I mean, you know, a lot of other things happened in between that aren't in the book, but you know, you can, you know, extract from your life and shape it into something. Yeah.
Yeah, and you said something interesting, and I think in terms of the truth, which is that right away, as soon as you're writing a memoir, you're taking out 97% of your life in a way. I mean, because there's so much little stuff that can't make it in. So you're still just giving a fraction of what your life actually is, isn't it? You're having to pull out so much.
That's so true. And, you know, and more than you even, like, I mean, even just for the three journeys that are in this book, like, for example, with panic, I tried so many remedies, so many different therapies, and from, you know, like traditional
right.
to like the most, yeah, are you thinking about the Tongren or? But, you know, I couldn't put every single one in because, you know, I thought that would just fatigue a reader, you know, like, oh, and here's another one, and here's another one. So I had to choose, you know, a few of the many to sort of that I thought best represented the larger journey through panic. And so, yeah, I think we're always making those kinds of choices, right, about, like, weighing what is, you know, what best represents the larger story.
You know what's interesting, and how this is the way for me that memoir is most like fiction, and I don't write fiction anymore. But when I did, you know, you're making the story up as you go along, and so there's all these different plot lines present themselves, and sometimes you follow them and they're no good. But I find memoir like that too, in that as you go along and you're writing, and tell me if you went through this. So you're writing the story of your life or the portions of it, but all along the way there's all these tendrils of stories of things that you. Of little storylines you could follow, all of them interesting, all of them happened to you, all of them true, and yet they didn't, maybe they belonged in the story, and maybe they didn't. Is that, and so
yeah.
I was doing that all the time, like, oh, this is an interesting story. That's right the time that happened to me. And then you try, like, oh, no, that's not a part of this story. Almost like
exactly.
A fiction writer getting a new character that's got to go.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, that's what we're doing, right? We're treating ourselves and the people in our lives as characters.
Oh, absolutely.
And, yeah, so it is. It's an interesting thing. And sometimes we've already talked about, you know, not every detail is important, but sometimes you're right. We write stories, we add stories in that are actually pretty good or intriguing, or
sure.
But they don't serve the larger kind of arc, so they have to go.
No, and if you're
then we
true,
wave goodbye.
You say goodbye. And the thing is, if you have a true memoirist kind of look at your life, which I've only come to understand I really do, and everything's a story, and anything could be interesting. I mean, anything, really. If you love to tell stories, your trip to the grocery store could be interesting if you found something in it. So the fact that it's an interesting story doesn't mean that it belongs, but the little storyteller mind, at least for me, is always, ooh, that's interesting. Let's go down that path.
It's the worst problem to have, to be so enchanted, you know, by stories that we have to pick and choose, right? As opposed to, you know, people talk a lot about writer's block, and you know, I don't know if I believe in it. I shouldn't say that because now it'll probably happen to me. But you know, I feel like for me, it's kind of like the same thing that you have, where it's like, oh, this would be a great story to tell. Oh, this one, constantly having to whittle it back down again.
Oh, they're all good. All of it's good. Life's interesting. Life is interesting. I've decided there is no mundane event. There's no mundane life. There's simply a mundane perception of it.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, I know. I was just talking to this guy who's trying to write his first memoir. He's a very successful nonfiction writer, but he's trying to attempt his first memoir. He's very insecure about it because he feels like, who cares? Who wants to hear from a guy like me? And I was like, look, there's no mundane life, but there are mundane perceptions of life. Now, you know what's interesting about you, Rita? I sometimes think someone like yourself has a bigger challenge, which is your life was so far from mundane, it would be tempting to not try and dig under the surface of all the gory details. Does that make sense? Like, you still had to get underneath the surface. You couldn't just list all the atrocious things, especially in your childhood.
No. And, you know, and also it's interesting because what I found in writing this is that because I lived it and survived it, it doesn't seem as – I feel
dramatic.
Like a reader who hasn't experienced it, it can be really hard to read. So I found myself being very protective of the reader. And there, you know, I know that it's still a harrowing – the childhood part is still harrowing, but there are many things that I opted not to put in because I thought that's just, you know, too hard to read. So it's an interesting thing to have empathy where you're protecting a reader from your own story, kind of. And, you know, I mean, I didn't soft pedal anything. And what I did include, I included, you know, as fully and truthfully as everything else, but I definitely had to make choices to not include other things. And again, it was like picking the enough events that sort of constituted, you know, a good sense of this life and why I would choose to start running away from it at a young age.
Right. Yeah, you have to build your case, don't you? You have to let people know.
You do a bit.
It seemed like a choice to make. You know, it wasn't the only choice you could make, but you got to understand. And so you laid it out. This is what I was running from.
Yeah. I think so. In fact, I really wanted to write the book without any of my childhood in it because I didn't want to write about my parents. Who are not actually identifiable from the book. But in the end, I knew that that story, you know, had to be told because it was part of the larger story and I couldn't leave it out because then a reader would say, what kid runs away from home at 11? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, and not only that, but the panic attacks obviously are linked to all that. I mean, not to play therapist here, but there's no way that, those things are not connected. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
As soon as you start, when I was reading that part, I said, well, of course this woman got panic attacks, you know, well, not of course, but it's a perfectly natural, you know, evolution of that life until you
right,
found
what
your
took you so long, right? I know. I was surprised. Yeah, I waited to my mid-30s to have it.
Yeah. Well, you waited until things were safe, until you were actually physically safe.
Isn't
right?
that interesting? Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't until my whole.
It's beautiful.
Pardon?
It's beautiful. The life was saying to you, your safety was never physical. It was always inside you. You had to find it once life said, here's the husband and there's the house and the yard and the blah, blah, blah. And still you weren't safe.
How
beautiful.
About that?
Yeah,
it is. It is because it's a whole, you know, kind of self-reliance. Like, oh, I have to come back to myself. And doesn't, like, none
That's
of that
right.
other stuff matters, you know, if, you know,
no.
it's like first, yeah. So it was a way to, you know, find my own, like, reconnect with my own strength. Again, and I needed to, and also had to process some of the stuff from my childhood. You are absolutely right.
Sure. Well, all right. Now, will we be getting another book from you, Rita? I hope so.
Thank you. I hope so too. I'm actually toying with a novel and also another memoir. So those two things are on the horizon right now.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to reading the next offering. And all right, well, listen, we got a couple minutes left. So I got two more questions for you. Here's the first one, and this might be too long a question to answer in the time we have left, but give it a shot. So there's what you knew about your life before you wrote Let the Tornado Come, and what did you learn about yourself and your life after you wrote it? What changed in your perception, if anything, of who
you read
it?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, well, one is, like I said, and this only recently happened, where I realized that I am very stubborn. I think that what I learned is that we don't have to let our pasts define who we are. And, you know, one of the things I struggled with in writing this book is that my husband was afraid of my past and didn't want to read my book. And so so it's like walking around feeling ashamed of my past, ashamed that I have panic attacks. And to what I learned is that so many people are struggling with anxiety or panic and that there's just no place for shame. And so that was a real gift that writing this book gave me.
Great. Great. Writing is such a treat, man, especially about your own life.
It is.
Because you're forced to tell the story again. You're supposed to read. You have to redefine. And once you, you know, and isn't it true, Rita, that once you've told the story of your life differently, your life changes. When you change that story, at least for me, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
well,
for
there's
real.
A way in which you've taken control and you've actually manipulated the events of your life and made meaning out of them. And what is more
That's
empowering
right.
than that?
You can't be a victim. You can't be
exactly.
a victim. Even in your childhood, it doesn't work. That's why it's
no.
great, because you're teaching memoir, aren't you? And even if your students never finish their memoir, you can maybe teach them that.
I hope so. Yeah, there's, you know, we're all victims and we're all not. So nobody wants to hear, you know, somebody like kind of wallowing in self-pity. It doesn't.
No.
It's, yeah. So.
Doesn't work. All right. So I got one more question for you, Rita. One more. And what I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
To be surprised. To let myself
Ooh.
Be surprised.
I like it. Be surprised. Yes, I think that's a good answer. I think we're going to leave it at that. Well, Rita, this went by very, very quickly, and I have to say I thoroughly enjoyed it.
As did I. Thank you so much, Bill. It's really a pleasure. I feel like we should just be sitting down with cups of tea and continuing the conversation.
Absolutely.
So thanks for having me.
If you ever come to Seattle, especially to the Pacific Northwest Writers Association Summer Conference, maybe one day you will, we will have to have that cup of tea. In the meantime, Let the Tornado Come. It's available where all books are sold. Yes, by Simon & Schuster?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay, well, good luck. Enjoy your tour, and enjoy your writing.
Thank you so much, and same to you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
With the writing, not the tour, obviously, but yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rita. Surprise. It's true. Rita's correct. Let yourself be surprised. And by the way, if you're listening to me and you wonder why it says we have 14 minutes left, technically we do, but I decided I was tired of being cut off by Blog Talk Radio, and so I give myself extra time if I want it, but I'm going to be signing off soon. But yes, be surprised. And you know why? Because think about it, people. When you write, you know, you sit down there, you can have a plan, and you know that you don't really know what's coming down from the imagination. You know you can't really plan it out. You know that you have to go to that blank page and see what the imagination gives you. It's all about embracing the surprise. Oh, it's delicious when you do. All right. Well, listen, I don't know who's going to be with me next week. I think it's going to be Pam Binder, president of the Pacific Northwest Writers Association. At least I hope it will. But until then, what I want you all to do is do what you love. Write what you love. Love who you love. Be with who you love. And you can't go wrong. No, you can't.